welcome everybody to the bill on, somebody tell me the name, you Keeners.
Same old thing.
Same old thing, right. And we're asking the question of what settings are overused and underused in science fiction and fantasy and horror? What would you like to see more of and what would you like to see less of? If you're looking for more creative ideas, where should you go? And what works do you think have the most original settings? We have three, possibly four people on this panel. And what we'll do, I think, is have each panelist introduce themselves, give a little bit of their background on writing and with science fiction, and try and keep it to 60 seconds. We'll then go through some of these questions. I think I've got a few areas I would like to see the panelists give some opinions on. And after that, we'll open it up to the audience for questions, maybe at around 20 minutes, two or something. That sound good to everybody? Okay, cool. Greg, why don't you go first?
Okay. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University in New York City. And I'm also a fantasy author. I teach courses in fantasy fiction there. And my first novel was published last year. It's called The Third Sign. And I have two books out on submission through my agent. I'm also doing some freelance work. And the first book has been optioned for a film by an independent British filmmaker. That happened about 2 days ago, so that's very cool. I teach fantasy and science fiction, as I said, and so I'm interested in talking a little bit about all of these genres that we discuss, even though I pretty much stay away from science fiction myself as a writer. But
I'm Karina Sundersmith. I make my living as a writer, but as a boring technical writer. I also work for Back of Phoenix Books, and I write fantasy. I'm known primarily for short fiction right now, because the novel's not finished. I was nominated for the Nebula a couple years back. I did not win.
But you were nominated.
I was nominated, and it was an honor.
My name is Derek Kunskin. I've got short fiction publications in fantasy and science fiction, and I have some literature publication as well. I've got one novel circulating with publishers, and I've got another one I'm about to send out soon. In my spare time, when I'm not at my day job and not writing, I also do reviews of comic books under a pen name at weeklycomicbookreview.com. Check it out. I have settings to me is one of the pet peeves in sci-fi and fantasy. Rick, come on in.
Hi.
How you doing?
Fine.
We're still in introductions. So
obviously just got here.
Yeah, no, just in time.
I missed before you, so.
And I was going to say that cliches are a pet peeve of mine. And so I think settings are certainly a place where you can find a whole lot of cliches. And for me, a cliche is anything I've seen before or, you know, that doesn't leap out at me with originality. So my sense of cliche is probably overly tense. And this is our good friend Rick Wilbur, who is from Florida.
Now from Florida. Yeah. Lewiston for 6 years and now St. Pete.
Well, why don't you take 60 seconds to tell people about yourself, and then
I'm published about 50 short stories in all the usual places, and I'm administrator of the Dell Magazines Award, which used to be the Asimov Award, and a couple of novels, and I'm a college professor, and I write college textbooks, which is where I make the money, because you don't make them writing short stories for as much. This will be fun for me to be on, because I just sold a novella just 2 days ago to Asimov's, which is the same old setting I've used like 30 times. So I'm gonna be proof positive that you can milk a setting for a lot of stories over the years. So
okay,
that's it for me.
Well, why don't we get into a couple of the questions then? Let's hit the first one. Whether you want science fiction, fantasy, or horror. What do the panelists think? Which settings are overused? Would you like to start?
I'm going to say, people usually say, oh, we overuse the medieval Europe in fantasy. And my argument is actually that we have not overused actual medieval European settings. We have overused stolen from Tolkien settings. We have rewritten that fantasy world so many times you get lots of different variations. You get other authors' flavors on fantasy land, and that irritates the crap out of me, frankly, because there are so many books where you could take the plot, lift it from one, and chuck it into the other and have no change. You don't need to change the story at all. It totally fits into your nice little fantasy land. And that's just laziness. I think that is pure laziness on the part of the writer, and we as readers have just been accepting it. Because in a sense, there's something, you know, comforting and familiar about it. You sort of, you know how that world works, but it's not interesting anymore.
Rick?
I would slightly disagree. Because... no, but only slightly. And that is in that, you know, we all live in science fiction or fantasy world here. And there's sort of an unwritten contract between the writer and the reader. And I mean, even something that's been done by a lot of people can still be entertaining and enjoyable if it's done well. Mm-hmm. And something that's brand new and exciting and fresh can be unreadable if it's not done well. Yeah. I just finished a novel by Modisset, L-E, yeah. And it, you know, it's a whole series he's doing. Mm-hmm. How unusual that is. and it's a distant world where some sort of Amazonian powerful women have crash landed their spacecraft and they've had to revert back to sort of you know, medieval level technology. And there's some magic thrown in there. And I've seen all of this stuff a million times before. But you know what? He's a good writer, and I was entertained, and I read it, and I was turning the pages, and I was waiting to see how she was going to win the next battle, you know, the great warrior queen.
But you can have an entertaining story that's using one of the same old setting. That doesn't mean it's not overused.
Well, you know, I mean, yes, it might be overused, but yes, I'm...
But you're not bored with it yet?
No, yeah, I was. Well, I didn't like the ending, but
let me.
That's a different story.
Let me turn this to Greg before we go on, because I like the differing viewpoints, and I think Greg and I will have a couple of things to say about this too.
So. Yeah, I'm probably a little more with Rick, I think, on this, only because. I thought I was going to be swimming against the tide. I'm really frustrated. No,
I'm keeping score.
Yeah. Because, and part of that is this sort of the reception, when I was trying to get my first book published, one of the things that I was told, this is an epic fantasy, and 99% of the fantasy that I write, my second series and third series, has nothing to do with epic fantasy at all. It's fantasy, but it's not that at all. But my first series happened to be epic fantasy, in part because my imagination had been charged, as I think many of us here at this convention probably were, by the worlds of Tolkien or the reimagined worlds of Tolkien, you know, read through, you know, Brooks or, you know, Eddings or, you know, any one of these people, or McKiernan or someone like that, right? And so, so for me, this was almost sort of a tribute to some of those things that they had done. And I had to try to trace a line between being slavishly imitative of that, and I agree with you that that is frustrating, just to read stuff like that, which is just really cookie-cutter stuff, and to sort of make a variation on the theme. And so what I found later on, and I think I came to Rick's opinion about this in part because of this process, is that I'm much more interested in the quality of the storytelling one way or the other. I think what happens is that as something gets incredibly overused, then the storytelling quality diminishes in part, because the authors know they're mailing it in, right? I mean, they're aware as they're writing it that the settings are fake and or just sort of two-dimensional because they only really lifted them from another book anyway,
like,
you know.
Setting shorthand.
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, look, dressed in a green cloak, a guy who shoots an arrow from 700 feet away, and he's got slightly pointed ear. Who could that possibly be? You know, what race could that, you know? So that sort of thing is mailing it in, but I think that what we actually, one of the things I think is interesting, hopefully we'll talk about on this panel, is that I think sometimes there has been an overreaction to that in the sense that then, if you see anybody who, there's a sword? No, get them out. How dare you? You know, and I personally have a problem with that because I think that diminishes us on both levels. So I don't like us staying in one box alone. I also don't like us avoiding that box for fear that it might, you know, attract us again the way that it has for Rick in the example he gave in the Destitute's work. So I kind of try to trace a middle ground a little bit myself. So I'm more interested, I think, in the quality than in the I've seen it done before sort of thing.
I like your balanced opinion, but I'm going to fall on Karina's side on this.
Oh, good.
But I do...
So we're split, right?
Yeah, exactly. So...
It's 2-2,
right.
Okay, Mark, first, you keep
I recognize what you're saying
basically on this site about there are some conventions, and I mean conventions are a type of shorthand that editors use to make sure that they hit at least some of their target audience, to make sure they sell some books, because they got to make some money somewhere. And I take as well that it depends on what people want. My dad, for example, and I, we both read fantasy and sci-fi, and I can give him something like, you know, Red Mars, and he won't like it. He wants something that he's seen 50 times before, and that's fine. I do want something different, and I do notice that I do get the reaction like, you know, oh, great, he's got a sword. Fantastic. You know, I haven't seen that before, but come on, couldn't it be anything different? You know,
sure.
At some point, somewhere, somebody did use something different. And before coming to the panel, I thought of a couple of things, and I really like Karina's observation that it's not necessarily medieval, Western, you know, England and France that we've overused. It's been Fantasyland. And I had noticed as well that, you know, I thought that forested Northern Hemisphere stuff has been overused, but I'll go with Karina that it's the made up thing that we all subscribe to. I think in sci-fi, one of the things that I'm starting to get pretty tired of is extrapolations of Western culture going into the stars. I mean, we're presuming that Western culture is going to be the dominant pole for the next 1,000 years, and you know, history. Yeah, and a lot of cultures and history itself disagrees. I mean, you know, we're due to take second spot to whoever at some point. I think I'm getting a little suspicious of how the culture that goes to the stars is intensely secular and liberal. There are some real intense people out there who believe very different things than we do, who believe different things about religion and rights and other things, and they have just as much chance of going places as we do. And I think these are, you know, I would like to see religious culture going into the sky and stuff and see more of it. And I think there's room for that. On the fantasy side, I see a lot of Western, what I call Western moral settings. Because I think a lot of what we do is we've imposed a certain amount of Western culture and Western morality on whatever setting we choose, whether it's a green cloak and pointy ears, or whether it's Red Mars, there's still this Western morality, and I don't see a lot of other types of ways people interact, despite the fact that history, and even the modern day, has tons and tons of different ways that people can interact. And even the least bit of world travel will give you all sorts of examples. So, go ahead.
I actually just wanted to pick up, because when you're talking about, you know, X culture goes to the stars, or who is it going to be who's going to go there, what we're seeing increasingly is that we're getting a more and more multicultural world. So I have the feeling that what we're going to be dealing with, or maybe the stories we should be telling, is not about, you know, Western culture goes to the stars, China goes to the stars, but this gigantic mix of cultures, like we have in Toronto, like we have all over the world, end up going to the stars, so that you have your disagreements there. It's not we all follow religion X, and you know we have debates with the aliens about whether our religion is right. No, because we've got 17 on this one ship alone, and we can't agree amongst ourselves, never mind with the aliens. I feel that people have really sort of narrowed down their options and picking, you know, who's going to be the dominant culture. Well, who the hell said we have to have a dominant culture? Can't we make up a story where that is not the reality we're dealing with?
I do wonder sometimes, though, whether we're not looking at the shadow of what dominated as much as we are what actually dominates today. If you look at somebody like David Anthony Durham and Acacia, which is a tremendous book and is very much opposite to what we've been talking about here, which is, you know, intentionally and broadly multicultural, and which assumes an empire led by some kind of African-American referent point, actually, and then has a number of other cultures that, you know, sort of juggle for supremacy, sort of George Martin style. That sort of thing, I think, suggests that maybe we're starting to move in a different direction because of the increasing popularity of that kind of work. I wonder sometimes a little bit if, as much as it's true that we continue to consume the sort of, you know, the Modesta type books, and those things will continue to sell, it seems to me that that hasn't necessarily anymore limited the market to the same degree for these other works, because I think precisely for the reasons you're talking about, there is an increasing taste and interest in these sort of new approaches to, at least on the fantasy side, new approaches to a much more multicultural environment, which is way, way overdue, and it's not like this is brand new. Le Guin was doing it in Wizard of Earthsea, but at least there's sort of a movement to try to look, I think, more at that work. And so while I wouldn't claim that it's sort of overridden this and that epic fantasy is this pale shadow, I understand that's still a major, major force in the genre. I'm not convinced that it is the dominant, oh, we never do anything else force that it used to be. I think it's changed rather substantively. And in short stories, which react much more, you know, agilely, I think, than novels do, the short stories, I think, reflect this to an even greater degree, where there's an increasing attention to other work that's not necessarily just sort of Western-dominated, I think, from what I've been able to tell. But, you know, it's just my view.
Do we want to go to the question of what would you like to see more of, or does anybody else want to react to that?
I want to react to this.
Okay.
Because my score is 2-2, so
it's totally 2-2.
All right. We all emerge from the cultures we're in, and so what I've heard just for the last 5 or 10 minutes here is a particularly Canadian view of the world. Mm-hmm. The whole multicultural, the embracing of that, and that makes great sense, and it's great, but it's a particular, and when you talk
from
about
New York.
But it is.
I love Canada.
But yeah,
if you were in Canada,
we didn't like Canada, we wouldn't have come over.
I mean, that's right.
All
that's
right.
Right.
Well, a lot of people in the state have Canada envy. So.
No, that's right. I just don't want you to paint yourself into a corner.
All right. So, but the other thing is that I'm not sure that these cliches aren't also culturally bound. I think of. Near future hard science fiction, and I think that written by United States authors tends to be politically very conservative and very bellicose. And then I read near future hard science fiction by British authors, and it's socialist paradise,
yeah.
It's communism,
yeah.
and it's succeeding admirably, and so. And of course, those China and the Gang are all very popular and successful in that culture that has sort of embraced that. And I guess there's probably doctoral dissertations being read on what follows and what leads between those two things. Certainly, they sort of work together. But I think that we don't want to get trapped in thinking because we're here right now in Toronto that. All of this extends outside of that.
Okay.
But one of the great things about all cultures is that all of these things are there for writers. You just you need to feel if you want to go try something new, the only thing that's keeping you from succeeding with finding an utterly new setting and another utterly new approach is can you convince someone to publish it, or you publish it yourself. I mean, that's sort of your choice these days. And filtering it, so really, ultimately, what we're talking about is filtering that through an editor's culture.
And they have to make buying decisions.
There you go. Yeah. And so that ultimately winds up even with setting. Yes, I want to do this really innovative setting, but if I can't convince an editor to buy that setting.
The editor and then the general book buying population.
Sure.
So do you think that maybe that's at the root of why certain things end up being so popular is because writers are reflecting our culture to us?
You know, some writers, myself included, get trapped, you know, mm-hmm. by something that works, and that's all they want to see is something that works. You know, I sort of unfortunately have written a lot of sort of baseball fantasy. It's really stupid sort of subgenre to be in. But when editors send me an email...
Oh, you're serious! Sorry.
Yeah. But he cornered the market on it, though, Rick. I mean,
I published 25 of those. And on the one hand, I feel trapped by it, but on the other hand, it sure is comfortable. You know, it's like eating dark chocolate. Yeah, I know what this tastes like. So you sort of work with what you work with,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's both micro and macro.
But baseball fantasy can't be that cliche yet if there's only one writer cornering the market on it. You know? So when everybody's writing baseball fantasy, then we'll come to you and we'll say, Rick, we need you to...
Okay. Guy with a wooden stick, we all know that guy.
Yeah. sea turtle or something.
Yeah.
But, you know...
30 seconds?
I'm sorry. Yeah, quick. I just wanted to jump in and mention that I actually met Rick last year, and Rick is going to be one of the authors, if we ever sell the thing, of an anthology in speculative fiction and politics, which I'm co-editing with John Helfers, who's a Hugo nominee. And part of the interesting thing about that is that you have a broadly based multicultural author base and subject base within the broader context of politics. So, you know, how people are going to take it within that theme is entirely up to them. It just has to be connected some way to those two worlds. And there's going to be, if all goes well, two volumes, one in science fiction and one in fantasy exclusively. And then what versions of fantasy, what kinds of science fiction, and how each person wants to approach it. You know, Tony Pye is going to be writing for this. So I think that that demonstrates that there can be variety within a particular genre if we can find the publisher who's willing to, you know, sell it and see whether we can reflect something else, let's say, back to the book-buying populace. But again, that indicates to me that authors are interested in writing it. Part of the question then becomes, can we make both, you know, writers and readers be willing to embrace that as one of the things that they're willing to buy along with things like this, and I hope they will buy epic fantasy, obviously, but I hope that they will also buy other forms of fantasy, both for my own reasons and for broader genre reasons, because I think it's important for all of us to have different worlds to work with. So I think authors are willing to write it. It's, you know, whether people will be willing to read it, we'll see. I think over time they will. Sorry, that was more than 30 seconds.
No, that's okay. Let me ask this question to the audience. How many people are here in this, listening to this panel, because they're writers and they're hoping to hear things about writing? Okay. For a bit. Then why don't we go into what the panel, all of whom are published writers, what would you like to see more of when you're reading, and what would you like to, you know, what things would, you know, get your fire going on writing? Care to start again?
I'm just thinking, I want to read the thing that I cannot yet predict sitting here. I want the thing that I do not see coming, that I open up and go, you know, something really different and creative, which, of course, if I could say, here, I want to see more about X, then it's probably not that original.
Well, what settings haven't you seen? What settings would you think, wow, that would be kind of fun to write about?
Personally?
Yeah.
Or just in general?
No, just you.
That's me. You see, when you want to talk about cliches, I cliched myself into all kinds of weird fantasy post-apocalyptic settings, so I'm trying to break out of that, I suppose.
Has that become a cliche setting?
I haven't read a lot of post-apocalyptic.
It might be my version of baseball fantasy. Magical post-apocalyptic fantasy. You know, I end up every year teaching at the Alpha Workshop for team writers, and we were having a conversation about writing for anthologies, actually. And we were talking about how when you're coming up with an idea for an anthology on a theme, you usually can get a couple of good ideas, if not right off the bat, after a bit of thought. And usually those are the things that people write. And the argument that we were having was that chances are, if you thought of it fairly quickly, it's not very good. Or at least not very original.
Yeah.
And so we were sort of talking about how to take the type of stories you're telling. One of the examples was taking the classic story that you would tell and switching the setting. I'm trying to think of some of the examples that we used. I would like to see odd things. Like, I would like a story about wizards in World War II Germany. That would be interesting.
There we go.
You know, I want something just... I would like some things that deal with some of the more recent historical periods.
Mm-hmm.
With a twist. I'm tired of urban fantasy in generic urban land. Somebody recently published, it was Ilona Andrews, had a book that at the bookstore we defined as rural fantasy.
I like
it. Which it was, and it was a pretty good rural fantasy. And, you know, it was much more the pickup trucks modern world, and I think I would like stories like that. Fewer vampires and
vampire-free zone, right?
Yes, please.
Yeah, please. Unless they're done right.
Unless you're Robert McKinley, then you're allowed.
What about, all right, Rick, how about you for that question? What types of things would you like to read about? Like, what would seem fresh to you if you were reading it? And, or what would you think would be fresh to write about?
Well, I'll tell you, I read two or three books a week. And I have forever. No matter how busy my life is, I always read before I go to bed. So, and I try to read one science fiction or fantasy, and then I try to read one mainstream literary book, and then I'm usually reading something that I have to read for academic purposes. And that has always kept me, has been both good and bad. On the one hand, I never really get a real immersion into something, so I really understand what's going on in the field all the time, right? So last year I agreed, and I signed a piece of paper that said I wouldn't give any real details about this, but I was the judge for a big contest for thriller novels. And I read 50 thriller novels from September 1st to December 1st.
Have you had your nightlight on since then?
You know, after a while, you're completely immune.
Yes, but
there was nothing. There was no body part that would impress me. Right? I mean, it was just God. And it was very, very interesting because the reason that matters to this discussion is that's the first time in many, many years that I was just totally immersed in something. And yeah, I got to the point where I did not want to see certain things anymore, and I realized that's not really fair to this author, the fact that I happen to be reading this novel 35th, a novel that might have really impressed me if I was reading it 4th, right? But now I've seen this so many times. And I wish I could remember the name, and I feel really bad that I can't, but I read... But I encountered in reading those, they weren't all blood and guts. Some of them were sort of fantasy thrillers, or even steampunk kind of thrillers. And I got to admit, I got a thing for dirigibles. You know, I mean, I like that whole thing, right? And I think for me, what happens is when I'm reading certain kinds of material, if I get more from it than just the text, if I get a lot of interesting sort of meaty subtext to it, then I'm cool with it no matter where it's going. And if I don't, and when you're reading a lot of stuff and you're immersed in it, you very quickly get that this is all just surface action crap and it's not any good. Wow, this is kind of interesting. And I admit to having, I mean, we all have sort of blind spots. I understand the intellectual literary appeal of vampirism. I get it. Lots of good stuff there. I don't get zombies. I don't see where...
I love zombies.
I know. I understand.
Would a jockey say similar?
No, they're not similar at all. We're all vampires. We're all trying to suck the blood out of something else to live our lives. I mean, we're all... I'm a journalist. All journalists are vampires. You know, I mean, I see this all the time. I see we're all doing that, but zombies...
Look at people who live in the city... in our mindless routines, going about the day, not getting to do anything we want to do, we are zombies.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So the point would be, the point would be that I understand that it gets old, whatever the setting is, whatever you're reading too much of gets old, and you're looking for something fresh. And when you can find the publisher that will publish that fresh thing, that's terrific. The whole idea of politics, and I mean, I think that's a terrific idea. That'd be so much fun to do, convincing the right person to do that.
Maybe baseball politics.
Oh God! I will have to say, you mentioned sea turtles. This new novella I just sold to Asimov's has Kemp's Ridley sea turtles in it, which I use constantly. Because there's a great story about, you know, all the Kemp's Ridleys on Earth, all the moms go to one beach near Veracruz, Mexico, and lay their eggs once a year. And so it puts them at great hazard of just being wiped out by predators, human or otherwise. And so scientists have for many years been trying to get them to imprint on other beaches. And so I find that a really useful sort of thing. So along with baseball, I do a lot of Kemp's Ridley seeking. And I have a Down syndrome son, and I feel like I use Down syndrome way too much, you know.
But probably You're mining a few things, but there aren't a whole lot of people mining around the same areas.
Yes, and that might be good about the baseball thing maybe as well. As long as I'm not one of 10,000 miners.
Yeah.
Maybe that's an okay thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
I guess.
What about you, Craig?
I think the thing that I was thinking about that I'd most like to see is I have found increasingly that the fantasy that I read and science fiction that I read especially, we were talking before about this particular overused genre that comes to my mind is this post-apocalyptic thing, though I read it as science fiction. If I see one more thing about the end of the world and the world is coming, you know, and it's always this gripping new vision of the new, it was not, you know, V for Vendetta in 2012 and I Am Legend and oh my God, I mean, you know, how many times is the world going to blow up? Like, I thought apocalypse happens once, right? Like, I mean, by definition. So I find that I would be interested, I don't know whether I'd like to, how much of this I'd like to see, but I have seen almost no fantasy or science fiction recently that has a particularly optimistic bent. It all, to my mind, what I've been reading leads to chaos and destruction.
Shine.
And, sorry?
There's a new anthology out called Shine.
Oh, really?
Which is entirely optimistic.
Okay. I feel a little weird saying that because I don't, you know, it's like, I need to be happy. It's not exactly that. But it is more discussion, I think, of, you know, going back to this idea of mailing it in. Mm-hmm. I think the assumption that we will end up obliterated, destroyed, and at each other's throats is as unreasonable an assumption to make as that we will all be dancing around in fields with rainbows and bunnies. I think probably it will be somewhere in the middle. I think probably we will end up with some of us in chaos and some of us not, and we will probably end up with some people being good to each other and some not, just as the way we have always been. And so to assume then that there's some sort of corner on the market on truth based upon the more depressing and you know, the more people die, the more likely it is to be true,
but of course
I reject on faith.
But that's no fun to read. I mean, you need conflict, and so you need
that's
reality.
Right, of course, but that was the point that I was making before when you were talking about the Shine thing. My point is not, therefore, I want to read everything where everything always ends. My sense is that there's the sense of positivism in anything that I read at all feels to me to be very much absent. And that doesn't even mean that each individual work would have to necessarily end happily. It would mean that seeing some possibility for some redemptive quality somewhere would be nice.
All right,
just one other thing, I'm sorry, very quickly. My students, who have very little background in this at all, I teach an introductory course in fantasy and science fiction, give me this reaction before I have it. Their reaction is, Dr. Wilson, everything is just everything we see is so depressing, it's all doom and gloom. And when they have a chance, they just got finished reading The Last Unicorn. And they were all like, I was getting these responses I couldn't believe. I mean, yes, it was sad, but also at the same time, they didn't all die, and I couldn't believe, you know, and I'm like, you know, and they were like, it was really sad, but at least they didn't all die, you know, and I was just like, that's like the first time I didn't have to feel guilty that I was throwing, most of the time, I'm just like, you know, most of my classes here, I had Death of a Salesman, here, I have all these people die, here, you get some people that live, but the point was that I think they, as non-fantasy science fiction people, are reflecting that view, and I have to agree with them. I think there's something to be said for that view. Doesn't mean I want it in everything. It means I'd like a little of it, and I see very little of it in my own reading. So,
the thing is, I'm not going to disagree with the fact that there is a great deal of negativity. What I'm going to say, though, is that you cannot mistake the setting with the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you can have to use the example, you can have an apocalyptic story, you can have a post-apocalyptic setting, and you don't have to be telling that story about how everyone dies.
Mm-hmm.
You can have
somebody's got to get married after the apocalypse.
Honey, the world's ended, great. But break the cake.
Completely out on that field. That was great.
And
is that a baseball?
The white turtle
on
that field.
Give this man a turtle.
No, I don't know.
No, but you're right. So
the stories
can be about people within there.
Yeah, so maybe we shouldn't be letting the setting just dictate the story. So you tell the redemptive baseball story.
All baseball stories are about redemption. They're all about redemption.
Depressing baseball story where everyone dies.
So. No problem.
An entire team is drafted World War II.
But I mean, you can have the sort of the epic fantasy story that is not about people going places, is not about the bigger political world, but is a really small story about people who are living in one particular town and have never gone over the neighboring hill because we don't go over there.
Sure, but let me respond to that saying, I would compare two things. If you compare something like the Mad Max movies, which I think do have some redemptive quality to them, and you compare something like Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Now, I know that there is theoretically some aspect of it. I don't know how many people have not read it, so I don't want to spoil people, but theoretically you could argue.
You can't spoil that movie.
Okay. So there theoretically could be some...
Don't worry about spoiler warnings. We're in a panel.
Okay. You could theoretically twist it such that the fact that the boy manages to go on and be with some other group of people is technically redemptive. I personally don't find much redemptive about a book in which bleak event is followed by bleak event is followed by the death of the one thing that has kept this boy interested in the world. And then the result is, but you get to stay with us now at least.
No, I don't think that's redemptive at all.
Right, so my point being that I think, and so I totally agree with what you said, but I guess my point is I see much more of the Road version of post-apocalypse than I see of the Mad Max version of post-apocalypse. And I'm not comparing the literary quality of each. I'm not saying McCarthy's more. I'm just saying that in terms of sort of the overall emphasis. And so I agree entirely you could have something redemptive in that setting. I just don't see much of it. And I don't know whether the setting is dominating the story for the people that I read, but I don't see a lot of even pushing against the setting to do something that would be opposite post-apocalypse. That would be interesting.
So that's a case of... Another thing about writers being lazy in their settings, in the type of stories that they're telling.
Fair enough, sure.
Just as we're all getting locked in our own little boxes, that's the post-apocalyptic version of the guy with the sword.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that concept, pushing against the setting. That's terrific. I like that.
We've got a couple minutes before we open up for questions. I'd like to take a couple of shots around here. One thing I forgot to say at the beginning about the whole idea of cliche versus original, convention versus, you know, whether we've seen it enough, is something I've heard from a lot of editors when I've gone to conventions is that they see a lot of competent writing. You know, obviously there's 80 to 90% of it that doesn't cut the mustard, but there's still 10% that's quite good. But they say within that 10%, they're looking for the pieces that are original. And most of the 10% they're seeing that is well written is not original. Okay, and so this is a sign. Now, some of the places I disentangled the plot and the theme, which is what this discussion's been about, from the setting, because I do think they're different things. And so some of the things I came up with in terms of underuse that I think would fascinate me, and I'm going in no particular order, is I would be interested in seeing African stuff, real African stuff, old ancient African stuff, anything below, and as a...
Nnedi Okorafor.
Sorry?
Nnedi Okorafor.
Because I'm tight.
Yeah, that's her name. She is, of course, a Nigerian descent.
She does
Nigerian-based science fiction, actually, and fantasy for most. She has a Nigerian-based fantasy coming out for adults. The last one was a YA book, which was a Nigerian science fiction future.
I should probably read that.
And, of course, Mike Resnick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a second thing that would be really interesting to me is I think a lot of the fantasy around doesn't really get below the technology of towns, specialized labor, monumental architecture. There's very little at the tribal level, for example. And I think there's a whole world you could explore there, both in the way people interact and also in what the problems they face are. I think the Middle East is, and its cultures, if you go back earlier than the 1800s, I think is a huge, huge untapped mine. I've written a couple of stories in that period, and I would like to write some more. And I think they're just Islam itself as a religion and some of the ethics that go around that, I mean, aren't too different from Judeo-Christian, but I mean, some of the ways they differ from Western culture are quite interesting, and you don't need to twist too much to make things actually go interesting. China has 5,000 years of history. you've got them unifying in around, what was it, 220 BC. Before that, you had the warring states. Before that, you had other types of culture. Their magic systems, before they unified, they had some really, really weird-ass magic that had to do with scapula from bulls, and they did terrible things to tortoises.
sorry, Rick.
and this was their magic system, and they actually left records because tortoise shells don't decompose, and so we see every little thing they wrote on it. And wow, is it ever fascinating. And you've got, after that, you've got Han China, Tang, Sing, Song, you know, all of them.
Tony Pai, though, didn't he write for an anthology that was dealing largely with, I think it was for Daw, that was dealing with specifically set in Chinese settings, I believe. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think maybe last year.
One anthology,
though? Yeah, no, I'm right. Yeah. What I'm saying, it's a step in that direction.
Guy Kay's new book is a Tang Dynasty. Guy Kay version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but my point is, if you can name one anthology and one author,
yeah,
and we've exhausted the, you know.
But it's a good trend that people actually are starting to think in more divergent ways than perhaps we've been seeing before.
Cambodia. I can't think of a single story I've ever read about the Khmer, because the cultures that made that monumental architecture, you know, that I know nothing about that. Yeah. I would love to see a fantasy set there within
Jeff Ryman.
Okay. Within what they can, and I think the challenge of going to weird, like, and weird I use in a very limited way. What I mean is something that's unfamiliar to me. When you go to weird cultures and they have different, they already have existing magic systems, right? You don't need to invent this. You don't need to take it from Tolkien. Take what they were using. Use the tortoise shells, whatever. Mongolia, I think, would be really, really interesting. They have a long, long history of conflict with China, with other places, and yet at the same time, they've remained relatively tribal. They don't leave a lot of remains that last for thousands of years and are easy to dig up. And you've got then a mix then of you've got something, a culture you don't know much about, but at the same time, you've got a technology level that really requires you, as a writer, to dig and say, okay, now what can I do with 10,000 people on horseback? You know, and there's a whole lot of stuff. Indonesia has, 1,000 islands making up that country? The amount of different ethnic groups, I think, is in the hundreds in Indonesia. And every one of those ethnic groups is probably utterly unknown to us, and, you know, maybe somebody in the audience can name one writer that's touched them.
To Le Guin and David Anthony Durham again that I mentioned before.
Okay, this is why you don't go with university.
But as you say, I just said this, everyone's going to pounce. No, but as you say, I mean, as you said before, that you know, that doesn't mean congratulations, we're done. I mean, what it means is that there are some in the past who have considered it with Le Guin, and then some in the future, like Durham, who are starting to consider it. But I think you're quite right. Much more needs to be done in that area. That's a good example.
And these are all I'm pointing out is places where we know there are veins to be tapped, or we know that there are claims that have been exploited a little bit, but there's a lot more to do. And so I think I was the last speaker here, and what we can do now is just open it up to the room and also to our panelists to either react or to throw other stuff in or whatever you like. So
I just want to add one thing that, sure. I mean, I love that list of cultures, and I would actually, yes, love to see a bunch of stories, novels, actually. That use that, but I also don't want to have the idea that creating a new setting is just the idea of picking a different culture to base it on, but rather let's also try to use these things as inspiration and take something and then send it off in a totally different direction to actually create your own setting, create something that's totally new, but use a different jumping off point.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree with you completely.
Well, we went from a divided group to a unified panel. Yeah. So now
we've
think
come together.
Now we quit.
This is a redemptive panel. So let's open this up to the audience. What kind of questions have we got? Have we got other ideas, other points? Have we got it all wrong? Go ahead.
It occurs to me that I was trained as a European historian. So, and it occurs to me, just sort of that there's a lot of material in Europe Mm-hmm. It seems to me that is sort of outside fantasy land. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, I specialize in France, and there's some stuff there that would not, you know, be typical of your standard extruded fantasy product, or what you would expect from epic or heroic fantasy, for example. Or, you know, it sort of falls into, there's a lot of stuff that would fall into sort of too late for fantasy because there's gunpowder, you know, but too early for steampunk.
You're making me think of Mary Gentle.
Note.
And no, I mean, I don't recommend all of her books.
Okay.
Ash is great, which in the States is four books.
Yeah.
And I find her other books are definitely worth reading. She's a bit rambly, and will get obsessed with her self-absorbed characters.
This is why they're worth reading?
No, these are just, you know, I'm just giving the warnings. Her, she writes actual European fantasies that are unlike anything else I've ever seen, historically based, clearly very well researched, and is doing the thing where she's taking things off in a different direction. There's a whole section about Carthage under the Penitents, which is basically all of Carthage is dark. They can't grow nothing. Everything's bad, and they have to basically go out to the cultures and lands that are still have sunlight. And there's just a whole subplot going on. That's just something that is happening in this version of reality. I find it very fascinating.
It reminds me a little bit of Greer Gilman and Catherine Valente, too, especially in the case of Greer Gilman, who is astonishingly original in her use of language. And there, I mean, you can't really call it rambling. There, it's just sort of this beautiful playing with the language and just sort of watching as she does what she does. And she's not particularly prolific, I think, because it must take her freaking forever to write that book. I was just like, are you kidding me? And so it's interesting to sort of on a more meta level to talk about even different things that one could do with the craft of writing in that regard, and not just genre-specific, but what we do to actually make these books in the first place on a very basic creative level, which I think she is very, you know, she's one of the best at doing that sort of thing. So.
Earlier, there was some talk about this, but I'm just curious. In the discussion the panel had, it seemed at some point you would be discussing elements of settings that are like cliched elements, was how you opened up and talked about the baseball fantasy as a setting. But to me, when I hear baseball fantasy, I think of more of as a very particular genre. And I'm just wondering, do you guys feel that settings push genres or genres push settings? And what in that interaction is what's causing the clichéism or the tiredness? Because if it's at the point where he picked up a sword, and you're because there's some great science fiction set up in some very far out space with some very angry space marines who use a lot of really big swords, be very angry at you if that's your attitude.
Which, far away,
40,000 years, but that's beside the point. You know, like what is it that's actually creating the ennui? Because each individual of the panel has ennui with various different settings, and I'm wondering, is that because you're tired of how they are applied within their genre?
I think
you read 50 thrillers in 3 months. How many of those were set in Fantasyland? And how many would be more interesting if they weren't? Or if they were set in a steampunk setting or Star Wars? I'm just...
No, I mean, I'm...
I've stunned the panic.
Pondering.
No, that's really... You started me with baseball. I think of the setting is... this, because it's baseball, it tends to be. I mean, I think of Summerland. Do you read Summerland? But it's, you know, Elysian fields, and it's all of this sort of misty, and it's constrained by the diamond, and so the setting actually is important to the theme, and I mean, the setting sort of drives it all. Ultimately,
but would you still have a baseball fantasy novel if you had a bunch of dwarves doing it?
Could you?
Yeah, would that be my still be baseball fantasy
sure,
novel?
Sure, it would just like, be, yeah, I mean...
The baseball seems to be the key part in the baseball.
Yeah, how do we get baseball into this? That's the key.
They would mostly walk, I guess.
Right? small strike.
Small strike.
Small
strike.
I'm sorry, but...
But part of what, I mean, but I think you said it. I mean, settings, I think it's more interesting, actually, when settings in some ways become peripheral to, or at least don't become the aspect of the story that matters, or at least not exclusively so. And I think that's exactly what you were talking about before. When the setting dominates what we imagine will come out of that setting, then I think you are more likely to run into what you're talking about this cliche. And that's why when I was talking before about this, we were talking about pushing against setting and pushing against what it does to us. It is more interesting to imagine this great, colossal, you know, collapse of civilization if you want to do that. It's very interesting to have that be very much in the background. I use in my creative writing course, I use a book by Damon Knight about writing short fiction. And one of the points, it is really good, and one of the points that he makes in that book is that he sees a lot of stories about cancer patients. Yes. And the reason you get lots of stories about cancer patients is because kids from 18 to 22 go to the most horrifying thing they can imagine, and for many of them that is someone dying of cancer, and it is horrible. The problem is they tend to make awful stories, right? Because there's not a whole lot one can say other than one walks into the room and says, a cancer patient, how terrible. You feel sad about it, but there's nothing happening. What he says makes it interesting is when you write a story in which the person may or may not be dying of a terminal illness. He wrote a story in which there was someone who was doing that, but that was really insignificant to the point of the story. All that was a motivation for him to do something else, but it wasn't referred to continually. It wasn't constantly, I wonder what I'm going to do about this since I'll be dying of cancer in about 2 years, you know. So wink, wink, right? So that kind of moment means that I think we can write things that work, you know, that don't let the setting tell us, now do this, now do this, now do this. And maybe if we do more of that, we can get away from the boxes we're talking about.
I wanted to say, just on the topic of setting itself, I think it's worth maybe laying down some definitions, and here's where the rest of the panel will pile on me. But I
might be with you on my definitions.
Well, get on this side of the table then, because I'm going to need some help. Anyway, I was going to say that I, as a writer, I think I have some trouble with plot, right? And so a few years ago...
Here's a hammer.
Yeah, exactly. A few years ago, I thought I really need to get out of the fantasy and sci-fi genre, because I came to the realization that fantasy and sci-fi are really a genre that is dominated by setting. It's where you are, right? And then there are certain conventions that are attached to that setting, and that's where we get to the thing here where, you know, you expect one thing from the setting, and when the writer can give you something different, then you get surprised. And so I realized then that mystery, for example, is... And you can count suspense in that if you've read 50 novels in 3 months, is really a plot-dominated genre, right? And just so long as you have a dead body at the start and somebody's caught and justice is done at the end, you've got a mystery. And it doesn't matter where you put it. It doesn't matter if you put dwarves or elves or airline stewardesses. It's all good, just so long as you have that. And so I think your question about whether the setting pushes comes back to what Greg and Rick were saying about, you know, the setting comes with, after a while, after you've got enough in a particular setting, people will expect certain types of stories to go with it. And then that's when things start to get old. And if you remain restricted in your field of play and you keep doing the same plays, baseball analogy, then you get tired. The other thing I would say about the ennui you brought up is... Rick's example of reading 50 novels in 3 months is probably even less painful than what a regular editor or agent has to go through,
yeah,
right?
Think about that.
They're the gatekeepers, they're going to be expressing a magnified ennui for all of their readers, and they're going to be much more... They're going to be hypersensitive to anything that's new and fresh that suddenly makes them go, wow, this is actually good, I like it, you know, and... Or it could be that they decide that, you know, wow, no, my readers, just, I need something even duller than this. You know, I don't know, but...
that's more dull.
Yeah. That's my reaction to your question.
Can I make one caveat about the thriller point, which I think you're absolutely right about that it is plot-dominated, but the one thing I'd say about that is the thrillers that you remember, for example, I love the Bourne Identity movies. I think partly because I think Jason Bourne is a fascinating character, separate from what it is that he does. And that's a combination of, surprisingly, I didn't know he had it in him, but good acting from Matt Damon. And it's also, I think it's also the product of good storytelling that knows that you need a good character to make the story matter.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I use the example sometimes of a movie like Die Hard, right? You know, there's a classic you know, go get him type of action, you know, action movie. But the reason you remember Die Hard among all the other, you know, myriad Sylvester Stallone, Schwarzenegger action movies that have come and gone is because you care about the character of John McClane, who's this kind of not very impressive looking action hero who's in a really bad situation, and his relationship with the cop Al outside of the building, and the action sequences that happen matter because he matters and the characters matter. And so that's the other thing I would say. The only point I would say, you're totally right of being plot dominated, but again, there, the more that you think of it as of a piece and don't just say only plot or only story, and you kind of combine those things together, that's when you have real newness, I think, to something.
We've got
Bloody Feet help.
Yeah. We've got 4 minutes left. Any other questions, comments?
This might be too specific. Do you think I do notice in especially in fantasy and stuff that there is a sort of taiga sort of, you know, there's a lot of do you think deserts are overused or underused or can be used more as a way, as a setting for, you know, fantasy science fiction, or
I think they certainly they're useful. Sometimes there are particular books that are become so well known that it sort of screws up that setting for everybody else. And Dune has put a real damper on it. I mean, anytime you use creatures burrowing in the desert, you know, or people who have remarkable ability to cope with the desert. I mean, there are these instant comparisons from that great classic. So,
but you have other cultures that have survived in the deserts before. I actually just finished a novel, not a novel. I wrote a short story in February that was a fantasy surreal piece set in a province of Yemen. And so, you know, I had to take a look at the different culture that was there. It didn't matter too much that it was desert, but at least, you know, in the desert you don't have elves dancing around flowers, and I think that's important.
Yeah, I would be interested in seeing more stories that are based on actual desert cultures, you know, something that is not Dune. Because other than that, I'm trying to think of, beyond Dune, what are entirely desert-based.
You got the Bedouins that are the classic.
No, but what are novels that have been written about? Because I can think of ones that will use the desert as an obstacle. Like, oh crap, now we got to cross the desert.
Peter Brett's The Warded Man does a little bit of this, but not a whole bunch. I mean, there's a part of his book that is, but not exclusively.
Sarah mentioned Blue Sword from McKinley.
Yeah. That one was okay.
We want to get that one more question in, too.
To bring a couple of things to you, so start, I think, Corinne and Derek, you were talking about how, you know, fantasy gets kind of too westernized, and you get this, things get kind of too westernized, too western feeling, and Derek, you were mentioning a lot of settings that you'd like to see done in, say, fantasy or science fiction, and we talked to, you know, Ian McDonald comes up, and Mike Resnick, and others, like, let's say, Western authors who go to put things in, like, India or Africa or K, you know, doing books in China and stuff. Is there a risk to go to these weird, strange other settings from a Western point of view, is there not the risk, perhaps, of westernizing those settings?
Absolutely.
In other words, Disney?
I think to some extent you have to.
I mean, there are different ways you could frame that. You could be like sort of skeptical and say that, you know, there'd be almost a kind of appropriation.
That's a huge, enormous topic about writers and exclusivity and inclusivity and who's free to write about certain things and who's an outsider and shouldn't, and that's a.
Yeah.
You just opened up a discussion that too bad we don't have another hour.
But I mean, the short answer is if you're a skilled enough writer and you're an authentic and honest enough writer, I think probably I think you can do it. And I think there's a certain, given that you're going to be trying to sell this to a Western culture, you're going to have your translation happen in some way, like whether you really make hobbits to translate for it, or whether you endow some of the characters with enough Western characteristics to make them sympathetic and understandable. But this is all the basic nuts and bolts craft of writing, and if you're good enough, you can do it, and there's lots of ways to do it wrong. But that's a really good point.
Have any of you read Norman Spinrad's recent on books column in Asimov's. Because it's all about, in a sense, this cover.
He
focuses on different books by MacDonald and others who are not set in Western settings. And it actually created a bit of a firestorm online in the last month or so. And Oprah 4 and others were responding to Spinrad's rather westernized valuing or devaluing of other strange foreign settings. It's actually, it can be an inflammatory piece in some respects, but it speaks to a lot of these interesting issues.
There's kind of been a flame war about this for the last 2 years.
But you know, the value of going to strange other places, but maybe some of the cultural...
Who is free to say what about
Jesus? Exactly.
Yeah. Tricky business, actually. Yeah.
I'll say that since we're a minute over, thank you very much. You've been an excellent audience, and thanks to the panel. This is...
Thanks for moderating.